A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on September 6, 1992, in the series Images of God in the Stories of Jesus, entitled All is Grace. The scripture readings are Jonah 1, verses 1 through 10, chapter 3, verse 10 through chapter 4, verse 11. And Matthew 20, verses 1 through 16. The texts for the sermon are Jonah 4, verses 2, 4, and 11, and Matthew 20, verses 15 and 16. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
We are always tempted to shape God into our own image, but it is also true that the image of God that we carry has a shaping, determining effect upon us, the shape of our life, our attitude, our spirit, our conduct. And so the image of God with which we live is extremely important in our everyday activity, in our human relationships, in the larger cultural involvement. The image of God that we carry will very much shape the spirit of our life. And that's why we have been looking at the images of God in the stories of Jesus. The image of the prodigal lover, the father who receives the son home, the creditor that has two debtors who have nothing to pay, who freely forgives them both, the publican and the Pharisee, the publican casting himself on the mercy of God, the Pharisee seeking to establish his own merit and justify himself. The images of God in the stories of Jesus convey a God that is unconditionally loving and full of mercy. And last week I had you repeat after me, there is more mercy in God than there is sin in us. And that elicited from one of you, since the pew card was unsigned, I don't know who of you, but one of you said, this mercy of God, how does that relate to a Hitler or to a Saddam Hussein? Well, I would have thought perhaps that the paragraph that I quoted of Carlisle Marnie in the bulletin last week might have at least spoken to that somewhat, because there was no thought of downplaying the evil that we do, the evil of which we are capable. Marnie says, man is the most dangerous and savage of the beasts. His bite is poisonous. His hand is a club. His foot is a weapon. Knives, clubs, spears are projectiles to bear his hostility. Nothing in nature is so well equipped for hating or hurting. Confuse him and he may lash out at everything. Crowd him and he kills, robs, destroys. For his crime rate increases in proportion to his crowding. Deprive him and he retaliates. Impoverish him and he burns villas in the night. Enslave him and he revolts. Pamper him and he may poison you. Hire him and he may hate both you and your work. Love him too possessively and he is never weaned. Deny him too early and he never learns to love. Put him in cities and all of his animal nature comes out with perversions of every good thing, and so forth and so on. No, not a pretty picture, a true picture, an honest evaluation of the human condition. The mercy of God is for people like that. And the very natural question that arises about a Hitler or a Saddam Hussein arises because we still have not learned the lesson. Scratch yourself a little bit, and it's all there in all of us. Did you happen to see 60 Minutes last week? One of the most gripping segments I've ever seen. 50 years after the Holocaust, a Jewish psychiatrist got together the children of some of the Nazi leaders. Martin Bormann's son was one. The other names I didn't recognize. He got these children of these leaders who perpetrated the atrocities of the Nazi horror. He said, how do you feel about your fathers? How do you live with the heritage that is yours? It was really moving. Martin Bormann's son, a lad of, 9 or 14 years old, when he discovered at the end of the war the truth, who converted to Catholic faith and became a priest, I suppose, to live out a kind of atonement for the inheritance of his father. A woman, I don't remember her name, who couldn't speak for a moment, who wept, who told of the fear that haunted her, that being her father, might there be some genetic connection that would cause the beast to emerge in her? There they were, human beings, could be our neighbors, could have been one of us. That's the human condition. People capable of the most unspeakable, obscene atrocities. And all of that that is in them is in me as well. People who do evil things. But I would stop short of saying that people are evil. And I'm quite sure I am correct in reflecting the image of God in the story of Jesus to say that the mercy of God is for us one and all. And that which we hate and the horror that we heap one on another, God hates as well. But the mercy of God is precisely for people who are capable of unspeakable horror. And it is only the mercy of God that has a prayer to effect human transformation. No, I will stand by it. There is more mercy in God than there is sin in us. But I will admit to you that when we see wickedness, inhumanity, cruelty, when we see all of that being perpetrated by humankind, it causes us to hate it and hopefully to rise up against it. But unfortunately, it does something else to us. It causes us to hate the person. Like Jonah hated the Ninevites. Why? Nineveh, in its day, would make New York City today shine like the Big Apple. Huge metropolitan area, a sink of sin. God had enough. God said, "Hey, Jonah, go preach to Nineveh. Nineveh was to the east. Jonah caught the first boat west. Didn't want any of that preaching to Nineveh, because Nineveh was the enemy. The king of Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, the oppressor of Israel, the decimator of the North Kingdom. The enemy, the adversary on the horizon. Let Nineveh go to hell. Nineveh conjuring up judgment for itself. I can hardly wait, says Jonah. God says, go preach to Nineveh. Jonah says, no way. I know you. I'll preach. They'll heed. They'll repent. And you'll forgive. No way. Off to Tarshish. In the direction of Spain. A little Mediterranean cruise, if you please. But, of course, the Lord God was not to be outfoxed by the likes of Jonah. And so God blew a little bit, and the sea churned, and a shipwreck was imminent, and all of the sailors began to pray to their gods, and finally the captain found Jonah down in the hold of the ship, asleep, drugged on his own anger and hostility. He said, hey, get up, man, pray. If ever you've prayed, pray. The situation's desperate. And then they cast lots, and sure enough, it fell to Jonah. And Jonah said, yep, it's me. It's me. I'm running from God. And they said, well, what should we do? And he said, toss me over. And they did, and the sea calmed, and all was fine. Jonah, going down into the depths, got swallowed in the whale of a belly. And there, amidst the digestive juices of the big fish, had a little time to contemplate the call of God until God, feeling that perhaps the prophet got the point, God tickled the gullet of the big fish, and he burped Joseph up on dry land safe and sound and said, would you like to go to Nineveh? And to Nineveh he went, and he preached, and it was just as he said. They heeded, they repented, God forgave, and Jonah was so angry. God said, do you do well to be angry, Jonah? Yes, I do well. And so he said, I knew it would happen, because you're so soft. You're just a teddy bear. Just let people give a little inkling that maybe they are turning to you, and you just open up your arms. Yes, and it makes me very angry. So he went off, found the Pacific Palisades, which overlooked the city, thought he would see what was going to happen. Built himself a little booth, and kind of hot climate. God said to a plant, grow big fast. Covered him with shade. Jonah was as happy as a lark. He would have thought he was in a Holiday Inn overlooking the city. Poolside. Next morning, God says, worm, eat the plant. Plant goes zip. Sun comes out. Sultry breeze. Jonah can hardly stand it. God says, good morning, Jonah. You're angry. Yes, I'm angry. Jonah, you're angry. Because a plant that you didn't plant or nurture grew up in a night, withered in a night, and you're angry. Jonah, how do you think I feel about 120,000 people in Nineveh, to say nothing of the cattle? The story was told, the parable of Jonah was told in the post-exilic period after Judah came back from Babylon, from its exile experience, the time when the Pharisaic movement began, the separated ones, when they began to gather their skirts around them to be very righteous, to follow punctiliously the law, the ritual, to say their prayers, to do everything that they were supposed to do as recorded in the prayer of the Pharisee of last week. The righteous ones, the good ones, the serious ones. And as that society developed in a kind of narrow meanness of heart and spirit, somebody told the parable of Jonah in order to remind Israel in its exclusiveness and its narrowness and its nationalism, which translated also into a kind of particularism of religion. God is bigger than that. God has mercy on all people. But that movement to which that parable of Jonah was told came to the ascendancy, so that in the ministry of Jesus, it was that group to which he had to constantly defend himself and vindicate the gospel that he proclaimed and the behavior of his life. It was to the murmurers and the grumblers that Jesus had constantly to defend the fact that he received all sorts of people in his home synagogue, Luke 4, Nazareth, inaugural sermon. They almost killed him because he indicated that the grace of God was broader than the limits of a Jewish religion. And throughout his whole ministry, he told story after story in order to try to image God differently than the image of God that had shaped that narrow ecclesiastical exclusivism of the Judaism of his day. And he told a story about a man who owned a vineyard who went at 6 o'clock in the morning to the labor union office to find who was eligible for the day, and he negotiated a contract with a bunch of workers and sent them out into the field, 12 hours, a denarius. Is it a deal? It's a deal. Such a deal. Full day's work, full day's pay, honest wage for honest work, everything fair and square. About 9 o'clock in the morning, on his way to coffee, he saw a few standing idle there, and he said, "What are you guys doing?" They said, "Well, we're available." He said, "Get into the field, and I'll make it right with you. No contract negotiation now, no wage established, just I'll do right by you." 12 o'clock, the same thing. 3 o'clock, the same thing. About 5 o'clock, he was making his last pass, and he saw a few stand there. He said, "Where you guys been?" They said, "Well, every time you came before, we were in the John." Well, I mean, they didn't say that, but they probably were, because they really didn't want to work. They really wanted to be able to go home to their wife and say, "Well, there was no work today." He said, "Get in the field." So they worked for an hour. And when it came time to dole out the pay for the day, those who worked for an hour got a full day's wage for an hour's work. And so were those that came at 3 o'clock and 12 o'clock and 9 o'clock and 6 o'clock. And when those who were hired at 6 o'clock and had worked a whole day and had worked under the sweat of noontime heat and all of that, when they got the same wage as those who came at 5, they were angry. Wouldn't you have been angry? Be honest now, wouldn't you have been angry? Every normal human instinct in you should rise up and say, "That's not fair, that's not just." And that's true. And the owner of the vineyard said, look, did we negotiate? Have I lived up to the contract? Well, yes, but am I not able to do what I will with what is mine? Do you begrudge me my generosity? The anger that you're feeling is the anger that Jonah felt when wicked Nineveh repented and found grace. The image of God in this story of Jesus, let me suggest this to you. How about the promiscuous lover? Do you know the word promiscuous? I didn't say, are you? I said, do you know the word? You should have laughed a little bit. Because the word is usually identified with those of somewhat less than moral scruples. You know what the word means? Its root is in Latin, miseri, which is to mix or mingle. Promiseri, promiscuous, is to mix or mingle indiscriminately. That was the charge against the householder. That's what makes people angry about God. God has no capacity to discriminate. God is indiscriminate in the bestowal of God's gifts. God's mercy, God's love, God's grace flows indiscriminately, mixing and mingling those who have some claim upon it and those who have no claim upon it. God has no capacity to distinguish between those who are worthy and worthless, valuable and valueless, good and evil, black and white. With God, there aren't good guys and bad guys. God is promiscuous. And made Jonah angry. And it made the religious leaders in Jesus' day angry. Still makes the church angry. It's an interesting twist on this story of Jesus told by a rabbi. This is a true account recorded in the Jerusalem Talmud about the year 350. So following in the wake of Jesus' story by 300 years, and so probably either working off the same story that maybe had general circulation, or maybe an actual twisting of Jesus' story. But a rabbi, age 28, died. He died on the day that his son was born. He was a very worthy rabbi. And so the rabbis, his colleagues, gathered for his funeral, and a rabbi colleague gave the oration, the funeral oration, and he told this story, but with a twist. He told about a householder who went out and engaged laborers for the day, and as he observed their labor, he saw one fella that was tremendously industrious and competent and capable and fruitful. And after 2 hours of work, he went to that man and he said, come with me. Let us walk and talk today. And so for the rest of the day, they carried on conversation, walking and enjoying one another. And it came the end of the day and the time for the pay. And the man who had walked with the master all day long after working only 2 hours got the same pay as those who labored all day. And so those who labored all day said, why should he get a full day's pay? He only worked 2 hours. And the householder said, because he did more in 2 hours than the rest of you did all day long. And in this funeral oration, the rabbi said, God took our young brother early because he was more fruitful in his short life than many gray-haired scholars who live a whole lifetime. Now, do you get the twist? Do you see how the rabbi turned Jesus' story on its head? In Jesus' story, the ones who went to work at 5 o'clock received a full day's wage, and there was absolutely no justification for it. It shattered all conception of reason and justice and fairness. When the rabbi told the story about his brother, he had said, maybe God took him young, but it was because he was so worthy. There are only two options, two worlds described in those two stories. In Jesus' story, it is a world of promiscuous love, grace, and mercy on behalf of a God who does not seek to justify such promiscuous ways. In the rabbi's story, there is perfect justification because the reward followed the merit. The image of God in the story of Jesus is a God of promiscuous mercy, grace, and love, who refuses to justify his ways, who simply says to those who complain, to those who are angry, do you begrudge my generosity? And if we would be honest, we would say, yes, yes, God, we begrudge your generosity. We don't like that about you, and we don't like a world that's run that way. Let me twist the knife one more time. Jesus told the story to vindicate the gospel over against the Pharisees, the Jewish leaders of the day. But when the Gospel of Matthew was written, we've moved 3 or 4 decades down the line. And those Gospel writers wrote their stories, selected their stories, because what they wanted to do was not simply tell this story back here, but they wanted to speak to the church when they were writing. So that the story in Matthew's gospel is now addressed not to the Pharisees, it's addressed to the church. It is not the Jewish leaders anymore. It's so easy for us to read our Bible and say, oh, those bad Pharisees, and give it to them, Jesus, and we are with Jesus. Oh, no. No, Jesus had to tell the Pharisees. Matthew had to tell the church. And so do I. I got to tell you, if you heard this story, you don't like it. If you heard this story, you can understand Jonah's anger. Because this story says that God does not play fair. And the straighter you are, the more righteous you are, the more serious you are, the more industrious you are, the more you will be offended by God's promiscuity. You simply won't take it sitting down. And as I began, this matter is so important because it is our image of God that influences our behavior. It is our image of God that shapes our spirit. And if our image of God is not the image of Jesus, then we are going to be reflecting something quite foreign to the Jesus whom we claim to follow. Shall I make it concrete for you? Let me give you a contemporary example. Now, I'm not a politician. I could never make it. But if I were a politician, and if I were a Republican, I would be extremely nervous about the inroads that the religious right is making into the Republican Party. Now, here's a paradox for you. It is fundamental Christian people influencing a political party that are making a political party mean-spirited and divisive. It is Christian people. If I were a politician, and if I were a Republican, I would tremble before the prospect of Pat Robertson and Pat Buchanan setting the agenda for my party, because if I allowed it to take over, the party of Abraham Lincoln would be no more. Because the spirit that is being spewed out is the spirit of Jonah, who gets very angry with all of the sinners out there and wants to draw nice clean lines between those who are worthy and those who are not, those who are right and those who are wrong, and would be terribly offended at a God that could be promiscuously gracious across the board. Now I've said it. And do you do well to be angry?